MMR 101.3 FM. People of Note on Fine Music Radio is proudly brought to you each week at this time by Peter Turin Productions. You're listening to Fine Music Radio, and this is Rodney Trudgeon welcoming you to this week's edition of People of Note. At the Theatre on the Bay, Peter Turin's Theatre on the Bay, there's an Agatha Christie thriller, Witness for the Prosecution. A man accused of murdering a widow, the glamorous and enormously rich Emily French, to inherit her wealth. The stakes are high. Will Leonard survive the shocking witness testimony? Typical Agatha Christie, and just wonderful if, like me, you like Agatha Christie and all her novels. The director of that play is Alan Swerdlow, who's in the studio with me today. And Alan, welcome. Welcome back to Cape Town.
Thank you very much.
It's been a while, thanks to COVID and all that, hasn't it?
Yes, that strange thing called the pandemic.
Yes. I don't know how people like you survived, actors and directors, but here you are. You did survive.
Well, we're still standing.
Okay.
And, you know, we're still waiting for things to get back really to what we knew. But I think it shows something, the fact that people stuck to their guns, didn't drop out, kept going.
Well, here, for example, at the Theatre on the Bay, and certainly here at Artscape, we're getting good audiences. The symphony concerts are generally full. So, as you say, it is getting back. But let's talk about the play, first of all, before we find out all your deepest and darkest secrets. Witness for the Prosecution. This, am I right in saying it opened, it's all set in a court, isn't it?
No, it's primarily set in a court. And it is, I think most people know it, possibly, because of the famous film that was made, Billy Wilder and Charles Laughton playing the defense attorney, the defense QC rather, and Marlene Dietrich as the extraordinary character remained. Fascinating, fascinating. One of Agatha Christie's most complex characters, I think.
Which is saying something, actually.
Yeah, very much. Yeah. But this, I think, is really her best play, because after the early stuff in the 20s, 30s, and 40s, here she started really delving into the psychology of her characters and why they were like they were.
And does that happen in this play?
Oh, very much so. They are rich. They've fully rounded the characters. They're not just stereotypes who pop in, you know, anyone for tennis and, oh, by the way, daddy's dead. You know, that guy. We're not doing that at all. It is primarily a courtroom drama, and everybody loves a courtroom drama.
They do. Oh, it works, doesn't it, every time?
Completely. But it moves out. It goes into the chambers of Sir Wilfrid, the defense barrister. And I even moved one scene. It should have been in the chambers, but I moved it onto the embankment in London.
Gosh. A bit of a challenge for the set designer you've done.
Well, no problem there.
Okay.
We've got the wonderful Sarah Roberts, who did the set design, and she worked magic and with a fantastic soundscape that gives you that effect. We were so detailed with this production, working on things that every now and then the soundscape that you hear in the chambers, you hear a church bell tolling, and it's actually St. Clement's Danes church bell, because that's what you would hear if you were in the Inns of Court.
Wow, that must have been fun to research, apart from anything else.
There was a lot of research that we did. Well, together with Sarah, I really went delving into the whole background to this, because the Christie estate now are really trying to encourage people to revisit the plays, to do it in a new and interesting way. And so I really went back into the time. It is a period piece because the law changed. About the law about a wife testifying against her husband.
Oh, right, okay.
They would not allow witness for the prosecution.
Yes, I see, yeah. Okay.
And That changed in 1954. But prior to that, it was forbidden, unless there was some reason found for her to give testimony.
Right.
So I went digging into that, and I decided to set it in 1950, absolutely on the nail. 5 years since the war, rationing still in place, no petrol. People have to get around Shank's pony or on the buses. So in the soundtrack, we hear the buses
right, okay.
Continually. And the interesting thing that I dug up was, and didn't know, the Old Bailey was bombed during the war.
Oh, I didn't know that either.
And they, it didn't affect all the courtrooms. It was only one and a half courtrooms that were affected. Mm-hmm. And they were only repaired. The Old Bailey as such was, they only reopened as restored and complete in 1951. So the design is of a rather dilapidated Old Bailey.
Right.
And with tarpaulins and do not enter and areas that you can't go into because the ceiling might cave in on you.
Right, absolutely. I just want to get one thing right, Alan. Is this, did Agatha Christie write this as a play? It's not a novel that's been adapted to a play.
She wrote it as a novella.
Oh, okay.
Originally, back in the 20s. Very different, very different. But she took the seed and then teased that out into the play. And again, the interesting thing about the play is that this is the first professional production in South Africa. It hasn't been done before because of the size of the cast.
Is it a big cast?
The original, 32. That's the size of a musical.
My goodness, I was going to say.
But as I say, with the Christie estate saying, rethink, approach it. We know that, you know, 32 is way too many for a management to deal with. Mm. And I've managed through some judicious doubling to bring it down to a cast of 12.
That's quite some doing, my goodness. I want to talk to you more about this play because I, first of all, I must say I'm an absolute addict when it comes to Agatha Christie. I adore not only her stories and what she does with them, but her beautiful writing, her
yes.
beautiful English is irresistible. But I'm intrigued by your music choice. What is this piece? Miles Davis is going to do it for us.
Jean-Éric. Well, I chose that because we use it in the play.
Oh, there you go.
This is Romain's theme, this enigmatic character played by Marlene Dietrich in the movie, played here by Sharon Spiegel-Wagner. And I chose to do the play as a film noir because it's very much that.
Yeah.
And wanted that sound, wanted that aspect. Who else but Miles Davis? This is actually, it's a score he wrote for a movie called La Sonde de l'Achefaux, which is called Escalator to the Scaffold. It was a film that was done with Jean Moreau in the late 50s.
And Miles Davis wrote for that film?
Yes. And I just love it because it just gives you the feeling and the time and the shape and the mood more than anything else.
Thank you.
Miles Davis there, and that piece called Jean-Éric, and was the first choice of my guest on People of Note this week, Alan Swerdlow, who is here because he has directed the Agatha Christie play Witness for the Prosecution, which has just started at the Theatre on the Bay here in Cape Town. And while we were listening to that, Alan, I was just saying to you, we went back to the language, and you were telling me a lovely story about the barristers.
Yes.
And the way she wrote for them.
Well, one of the reasons I think that people love a courtroom drama is those cross-examination moments.
They are the best in any courtroom drama.
Oh, and when they're going, mm-hmm. and when they're starting to do the objections, Milad, and trying to take down their opposite number, the language is so rich and witty and cleverly worked. And she was an absolute, apparently she did used to go and sit in to court cases at the Old Bailey.
Oh, really?
Yes, just
doing
to listen.
Research. Yes, yes.
Just to listen to how people behaved in a courtroom, mm-hmm. and the kind of thing that happened with witnesses in the dock, with the barristers trying to tease out the truth.
What's interesting about this production, this play, Witness for the Prosecution, is that unlike so many of her books, it ends up in a courtroom. Usually we have Hercule Poirot or yes. Mrs. Marple, Maple, whatever it is, doing that thing in the crowd and pointing out somebody. So does it have the same sort of red herring thing and little clues here and there? And it's a whodunit, isn't it?
It is, because it starts off with the murder.
Yeah.
And, you know, who actually committed the murder? Mm-hmm. Leonard Vole has been arrested and is in the dock.
And he's the main suspect.
He's yeah. the main suspect. But it is, as I say, this is much more psychological than her usual. You know, you have Poirot going around the sitting room saying, but the question is...
yeah, the little grey cells.
the little grey cells. And the murderer is you, monsieur. But we don't have that. We just have very clever questioning of the various witnesses to tease out the truth. Yeah. I think the most famous line from the play is one that is said by Sir Wilfrid, who is the defense barrister. The question is, were you lying then or are you lying now? And it's really gone down. That is, you know, classic Agatha Christie.
Yes, absolutely.
I've been wandering the foyer at interval, listening to the audience in Johannesburg, and it is glorious because you're hearing people going, no, it's got to have been the housekeeper. No, it couldn't possibly be the housekeeper. It's so-and-so. And people are really trying to work it out. So classic Agatha Christie style. There are red herrings in shoals. In shoals. And right from the get-go. But very cleverly leading you. And you've got to, as the audience, we actually treat the audience as the jury in this production.
Ah, that's quite a good idea.
So the barristers turn and make their summing up statements directly to the audience.
So we have to think. You're making us think.
Absolutely. But again, the wit, the humor that creeps in. It's glorious. And we were also chatting about the little Easter eggs and thing. I've put in things all over the show. I'd say don't sit back and let it unfold. Watch everyone on that stage because there are people signaling various things very subtly and delicately, but things are happening. I introduced, in fact, in the chambers of Sir Wilfrid, there is a chess game underway, you know, one of those protracted chess games where somebody comes in one day and moves a single pawn and then 2 days later returns to move something else. And because this is a vast chess game, the entire play is a chess game.
Oh, that's interesting. You've enjoyed directing this, haven't you?
I loved it. I loved it because there was so much one could do. A, we were doing the whole period thing, going for the film noir feeling, making it look like that. I've got Dennis Hutchinson did the lighting design, and he has lit it like one of those film noirs. We've got the way in which it's clothed. The wonderful thing that Sarah Roberts has done is that it's not costume. They're wearing clothing, but it's clothing appropriate. How she found some of the stuff, I think we scoured every single vintage shop and secondhand clothing store in Johannesburg. There is so much that is absolutely authentic to the period, yeah. But it doesn't look like a costume that's been sewn especially for...
Yeah, a costume drama, yes. As they call them. Oh, that's an interesting angle.
We've got people wearing the right clothing. Well, at the time, because of rationing and things like that, yeah, if Granny was popping her clogs, the minute she breathed her last, you whipped that coat off her because it wasn't going to go into the incinerator by any means,
right.
Because you didn't know when you were going to be able to get a coat again.
Right.
So things like that, patch and make do is how people were living at the time.
I was intrigued by the size of the cast. You said 12 people.
Mm-hmm.
So it is a sort of ensemble piece, actually. If you've got 12 people, and that must be important as well for everyone to know where you as director are coming from.
To have a cast that size is a rarity.
These days, especially.
These days, yes. On the South African stage,
right.
Unfortunately. Peter first asked me to do it in 2020, and then the pandemic hit, and it all got pushed on.
Yeah.
But it was great, because it allowed me a chance to rethink. And in the interim, it was the change of attitude in the Christie estate, and they were going, do it the way you want to. Rethink it. Don't mummify the piece,
mm-hmm.
You know, set in amber or anything,
yes,
like that.
Yes.
And so I rethought it completely.
What a wonderful way to go through the pandemic.
Yes. Well, it was, because I was sitting one afternoon watching a whole string of really bad film noirs, British film noirs, on one of the streaming channels. And I suddenly went, that's it. It is a film noir. It's The Third Man. There are references. In fact, one of the characters, well, Romain, was in Berlin. Her husband, Leonard Vole, the accused, he was a soldier just post-war, when conscription was still in place in the UK.
Yeah.
And he manages to bring her to the UK. He rescues her from the Russian sector. And so there's also that. There's a touch of the Cold War. So we've got The Third Man influences and all of that. It was just such fun. And the audience seems to be having the same amount of fun.
Well, we're not going to give anything away on this program, because it will just ruin everything. Like saying who did it in The Mousetrap, which
You're not allowed to.
Exactly. They tell
you're
you.
You're not allowed to. At the end of the show, somebody stands up and says, please do not reveal.
Yeah. But you don't do this in this show.
No, we don't. We trust the audience.
Okay.
I did consider it.
Alan, your next piece is by Stephen Sondheim, Pacific Overtures. Tell me about what we're going to hear.
Right. Pacific Overtures was one of the most cerebral, I suppose, of the Sondheim musicals. And I just, like everyone, I just admire and love his work and think it's absolutely extraordinary. But he went and did this strange and unusual musical with Hal Prince, which is about the opening up of Japan in 1853 by Commodore Perry arriving from America, and the instatement of the Meiji dynasty in Japan, and how the sealed kingdom had been, you know, isolated, floating in the middle of the sea, and was suddenly being opened out to the Western world, and what it did to Japan. And it's done as a piece of kabuki theater. but as a musical at the same time. It uses all the kabuki tropes.
Yeah, yeah.
And the curtain that is pulled across the stage and the revolve, the use of a revolve, which comes from kabuki theater, all of that kind of thing, and the fact that all the roles are played by men until the very end of the show when Japan is westernized and women appear for the first time on the stage. And this happens at a moment because there is a treaty house. They decided that the only way they were going to, Japan was sacred, the only way they were going to allow the Americans to set foot on the sacred soil of Japan is not to let them set foot, but they were going to discuss political matters and find a treaty. So they laid mats on the beach up to a special treaty house that was built for the occasion, which was raised off the ground. And they went and sat in there, all the Americans and the representatives of the Japanese throne. And when the Americans left, they burnt it. They'd never been there.
Oh.
And it's, what is history? This song is, what is history? And it starts off, it's called Someone in the Tree, and it starts off with a young, it starts off with an old man who says, I was there. I saw it. I was someone in a tree. I was listening and watching. And is just observation, is that history? What makes history? And he wrote, it's like a three-act play in a single song.
Pardon me, I was there.
You were where?
At the treaty house.
At the treaty
there
house.
Was a tree.
Which was where?
Very near.
Over here.
Maybe over there, but there were trees then everywhere. May I show you, there
if
were
you
trees
please.
Then everywhere.
But you were there.
And I was there. Let me show you.
If you please.
I was younger then. I was good at climbing trees. I was younger then. I saw everything. I was hidden all the time. It was easier to climb. I was younger then. I saw everything. Where they came and where they went. I was part of the event. I was someone in the tree. I was younger then.
Tell him what I see.
I am in a tree. I am 10. I am in a tree.
I was younger then.
In between the eaves I can see. Tell me what I see. I was only 10.
I see men and matting. Some are old, some chatting.
If it happened, I was there. I saw everything. I was someone in the tree.
Tell him what I see.
Some of them have gold on their coats.
One of them has gold. He was younger then.
Someone crawls around passing notes.
Someone very old.
He was only 10.
And there's someone in a tree.
For the day is incomplete.
Without someone in the tree, nothing happened here.
I am hiding in the tree.
I'm a fragment of the day.
If I weren't, who's to say? Things would happen in the way that they happened here.
It's the fragment of the day.
It's the pebble, not the stream.
It's the ripple, not the sea. Not the building. tree.
Pardon me, I am here, if you please, I am also
they
here.
They kept drinking cups of tea.
They kept sitting on the floor.
They drank many cups of tea.
No, we told him that before.
If you please, I am here.
You are where?
In the treaty house.
The treaty
or very near.
Can you hear?
I'm below.
So I'm
underneath the floor, and so I can't see anything. I can hear them, but I can't see anything.
But you can hear.
But I can hear. Shall I listen?
If you please.
I can hear them now. I shall try to shift my knees. I can hear them now. I hear everything. I'm the part that's underneath. With my sword inside my sheath, I can hear them now. One is over me. If they knock, then I appear. I'm a part of what I hear. I'm the fragment underneath. I can hear them now.
Tell us what you hear.
First I hear a creak and a thump. Now I hear a clink. Then they talk a bit. Many times they shout when they speak. Other times they think, or they argue it. I hear floorboards groaning, angry growls, much droning. Since I hear them, they are there. As they argue it, I'm the listener underneath.
Someone reads a list from a box.
Someone talks of laws. Then they fan a bit.
Someone bangs a fist.
Someone knocks. Now there was a pause.
Then they argue it.
But we want, or you can, and we won't. But we need it, and we want, will you grant? If you don't, we concede it.
I may sat the night, and they lit yellow to
I'm all dead. If I were to say, if what happened is a way.
That's music by Stephen Sondheim from Pacific Overture's Someone in a Tree. And the second choice of my guest on this week's edition of People of Note here on Fine Music Radio, brought to you by Peter Turin Productions, and that's Alan Swerdlow, who has directed the play Witness for the Prosecution, which will be on at the Theatre on the Bay. And one of the things you mentioned earlier, Alan, when you spoke about wandering around the foyer, eavesdropping on the audience, because they, of course, would not recognize you because you're not on stage. You said you were very impressed in Johannesburg at how many young people there were. Like, you really seemed quite astonished.
There is hope. There really is hope for the future of theater in this country, mm-hmm. because for the first time in a long time, I am seeing young audiences. We're talking about people in their 20s and in their 30s and, you know, from the 40s on, we kind of expect them to be there. But they're coming to the theater now, and they're having a terrific time enjoying it. And I've always said, if you manage to grab their attention once, they're going to return and again and again and again. And so I am just, if this is the audience of the future, and they've got to be encouraged to come along, and it's not all on little mobile devices and, you know, done digitally. It's,
I
often in the early days trying to entice people in to say, you know, what do you like about movies? Oh, the 3D effect. Come to the theater. Every single character is in 3D, and you can actually reach out and touch them.
Yes, exactly. That's, I never thought of that. Of course, that's so true. And so the Johannesburg audience was nicely young. I think here in Cape Town as well, Peter's getting young people into the theatre on the Bay.
It's one of, if we want theatre to survive, we have to get that new young audience coming in. And
but also, what a play to get people, I mean, to be so gripped by who the actual culprit is right throughout the evening.
There are more twists and turns in this piece than in a Corkscrew, believe me. And the glory is every night you hear these gasps from the audience going, and you hear somebody saying, I never expected that. And it gets it. She really was the queen of being able to hook people and surprise them.
And take you down the wrong path. In fact,
you cannot predict where she's going.
Yes, absolutely. So what I wanted to talk about audiences and all that, you were just saying how sad it was just after the pandemic when everyone had to sit with a seat between them with no one there. How horrible that was. And I'm just astonished that you people, the acting fraternity, survived, because we struggled with our orchestra here badly.
I can imagine.
Yeah. But it is coming back slowly but surely.
Theatre, well, performance, all performance is a collective experience. There's something particularly in theatre that happens between the audience and the people on the stage. There's some kind of compact that they enter into. And it's magical because it has to be this collective experience.
Once you go and sit down and the lights go down, you're part of it.
They did tests. I think it was Johns Hopkins University did some tests where they wired up an audience to take their heart rates during a performance.
Yes.
And they discovered that by a third way in, everybody's heart rate had synchronized.
Good grief.
It really was a case of this collective being. The audience isn't a bunch of individuals. It becomes this one organism. And it's wonderful for actors to be able to deal with that and the response that they're getting coming from the audience. Wonderful two-way street.
Actors always say, you can tell quite soon if you've got the audience with you or not. I think with a play like this, you'll have the audience with you from the beginning. But an audience does make a huge difference, because there are obviously nights where you don't have a great crowd in.
And then you have to lure them in.
You have to lure them into the story.
Because it's about the storytelling. You have to work a little bit harder. But you, a good actor, an actor worth his salt, can definitely reach out and get those people in who are... I think part of the problem is because people are so used to sitting in their lounges staring at a glass screen. And it's not a two-way thing. That is just spectating.
Yes. It's not even 3D.
No, not at all. And people, you know, we talk about couch potatoes.
Yes.
I mean, they go and they become couch potatoes just staring at something that's happening. Movement and color. And not really registering. Whereas you go to the theater and you've got to listen. There was, for a long time, I think it was up until about the late 50s, the term that was used was, I'm going to hear Hamlet. I'm going to hear a play if you're going off to the theater.
Wow, yeah.
Because you have to listen.
Especially in something like Shakespeare.
In a movie,
and especially in this,
wonderful visuals, of course, and explosions and, you know, anything you can do on screen, bigger and better. But in a theatre, you've got to, the part of the compact that the audience makes with the performance is the power of the imagination.
Yeah.
We're kind of leaning on saying, come, join us. We're going to create this world together.
Alan, do you ever miss acting? Because when I met you years and years and years ago, in the last century or whenever it was, you were acting a lot. And now you're directing a lot. And it sounds to me, you've got a very good name as a director. And it sounds to me as though you love directing and you don't want to act.
I absolutely love it. The acting was great. I reached a point where I knew I wasn't, you know, look at me. You know, I'm short. I'm not going to be your leading man type. I wasn't going to get the roles that I wanted. But more importantly, when I was here studying at UCT Drama School, my professor at the time was Robert Moore. And he said to me quite early on, he said, you're a director. And I said, no, I'm going to be an actor. And he said, no, you're a director. And I said, why? And he said, because you see the big picture. You see the entire picture that's got to be up there. Whereas an actor has to be slightly selfish. They've got to look at it from their character's point of view, and they've got to concentrate on that. Anyway, at UCT, it was tradition that when you graduated, you had an hour with whoever was prof at the time. And they would say, look, these are your strong suits. These, you fall down here. This is what you should concentrate on, just to lead you into the profession itself. And when it came to my turn, Robert Moore again said, you're still a director as far as I'm concerned. And he grabbed a sheet of paper and he scribbled something on this piece of paper. And he folded it up, put it into an envelope and sealed it. And he said, here. Put this away, and the day you decide you want to direct, open it and read what I've said.
Did you do that?
And I managed to keep that envelope between. I really revered Robert. He was an extraordinary teacher and a wonderful director himself. And I kept it going back to Joburg, back to Cape Town over the years, and came the day, and I wanted to direct more than anything else, and I went digging through boxes and drawers, and I found that envelope, opened it, and it said, Alan, you're now about 33. I was 32.
Wow. Yeah.
And you still see the big picture. Love, Robert.
My goodness. That must have made you feel incredibly special.
That was, unfortunately, it passed away by that time. I couldn't pick up the phone and say,
you were right.
You were right. You were right. But that's the point. And I put all my energy into that.
Yeah.
Wanted to direct.
And here you are. Now, look, another piece of music, Invention. What is this?
Yes. Okay, this is just a piece of music that means something to me. Flim and the BBs,
yes,
a group in America. I've a very great friend of mine, originally from South Africa, who lives in San Diego, introduced me to the music of Flim and the BBs, and it's a piece that just reminds me of this friend of mine and my family. My brother and his brood live in San Diego County, which is, you know, San Diego extended.
Yeah.
And I go and visit them whenever I can. And it reminds me of the family. It's a nostalgic and sentimental bit. But the actual piece of music, I think you'll find interesting because they're riffing on Bach.
Are they?
Okay. Yeah, not actually quoting Bach, but stylistically they're riffing on Bach. And it's a contemporary group. Thank you.
Flim and the BBs. How about that? That piece called Invention. I think I might have picked up some Bach there, but you say it wasn't directly quoted, but sort of stylistically.
Stylistically.
Alan Swerdler is my guest as we race towards the end of the program. Time flies when you're having fun,
indeed,
as I'm sure it flew while you were doing your rehearsals, because it sounds as it's been a wonderful experience for you.
Absolutely.
Working on Witness for the prosecution. The director, Alan Swerdler, is with me. When I was reading through your biography and all that to get to remember who you are, because I've known you for so long. In fact, when I first met you, you were playing Puck in Midsummer's Dream in Durban,
right,
for NAPAC.
Yes.
That's a short actor's role.
It is. Fortunately, there are a few.
Yeah. But I see that you've also dipped into opera,
mm-hmm,
as a director. How did that come about? Because that's so different, surely.
Well, they often say that directors always end up doing opera if they stick to it. At some point, they're going to do an opera. I was asked, I was approached to for Cape Town Opera.
Mm-hmm.
It was a very interesting new piece, modern, comparatively modern piece called Postcards from Morocco. And I just loved it. We talk now very much what's happening in Europe is what they call régie théâtre in opera,
yeah,
where it's very much the director's vision, and they're doing all sorts of strange and interesting and extraordinary things, and it does give you a much bigger canvas, in a sense, and then you've got music to carry the emotion and the thoughts, and for a director, that is just, what a gift, what a beautiful box to open and discover, and I loved doing that, and I was given the chance by Cape Town Opera to direct a few, and I'd love to do it again, and I hope to do it again, because it requires the director to go into another realm, really. You've got to pull on every single technique and concept and idea that you have, and put it across to what is a very large company and a conductor and the orchestra, and it is, if
it is
all
vast.
Works, incredibly satisfying. If it doesn't work, you kind of go home and contemplate how best to top yourself.
Yes. Because also with opera, with singers as opposed to with actors, you've got to, the way you get them to move, you've got, mm-hmm, to bear in mind breathing and
all of the
sight lines for the conductor and all that sort of thing.
I'll tell you a very, very quick story. When a long time back, I was asked to do the fight direction for a production of Carmen that was done by Pacta Opera.
Right.
And the director who came out from Covent Garden came to me and he said, there's something I've always wanted. I wanted, end of Act One, I want a brawl on the stage. I want every single character fighting with the other characters. And that's how Carmen makes her escape. And it was a lovely set designed by Johann Engels, and there was an incomplete building at the side of the stage outside the bullring. And they had scaffolding, and they had hoists, and they had ropes and things like that. And I went, this is the way to do it. We're going to have her, Carmen's going to run up the scaffolding, running from the soldiers, kick over the ladder with one of the soldiers on it. She's going to be lifted up to the next level by the laborers, and they're eventually going to put her into this basket that they've been hauling bricks up and down. They're going to put her into the basket, lower her down into the waiting arms of the gypsies who carry her off, and out she goes. So I'm asked to explain this to the Carmen, who came from Romania. Cleopatra Kürcha was the singer.
Goodness.
Indeed. And her donzella was Antonio Barasorda. So
good,
we had Cleopatra
grief.
And Antonio. And I was told she didn't speak any English, so I was communicating with her in very fractured schoolboy French, and I explained this whole routine to her, and she turned to the company, and suddenly, in flawless English, she said, "This boy want me break my bloody neck." Okay, I break my bloody neck. And she went for it, and it was incredible. Opera singers are a lot more A lot tougher and a lot more malleable than most people think.
Interesting that you say tougher and malleable.
Yes.
So there you go. And then we have to leave it there because we're going to have a touch of opera now.
Yes.
Of your selection of music. But thank you for whetting our appetite so brilliantly on Agatha Christie's Witness for the Prosecution. It's going to be running at the Theatre on the Bay. Opens on Thursday, I think, and then runs for a while till the 10th of August, I think. So it's a nice long run as well here in Cape Town. And get along and see it. I can assure you, I love Agatha Christie, so this is going to be fun.
I'll tell you one thing.
Yes.
The butler definitely didn't do it.
Oh, dear. There I was thinking it was the butler. you've chosen an aria from The Marriage of Figaro, Mozart.
Yes.
Is there something you want to say about that?
Well, it's that incredible end of Marriage of Figaro. It is so brilliantly constructed, both musically and in terms of the plot and what has happened. At that moment where Count Almaviva suddenly realizes the error of his ways and falls to his knees and begs forgiveness from the Contessa. And what follows is probably the most sublime music that Mozart ever wrote.
Oh, it's goose flesh.
And it is just about peace and reconciliation and understanding each other and being human. And it gets me every time. I'm a mass of blubbering tears whenever I hear it.
And it's what we need. Alan, it's been a joy speaking to you. And I look forward to your next directorial event here in Cape Town.
Thank you, Rodney.
We'll be right back.
People of Note on Fine Music Radio was proudly brought to you by Peter Turin Productions.
FMR 101.3 FM.